Three masked gunmen seized a bus carrying 26 children and their driver. The kidnappers drove them 100 miles from Chowchilla, California, to a rock quarry. They buried the children and the driver alive 12 feet underground in a moving truck. While the driver and children managed to dig themselves out, the 28-hour nightmare still haunts them.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. And this case is wild. Anne was also spearheaded by Greg, so we are both going to tell this story. You see, my mom's in town and Greg offered to write this episode because he was so interested in the case, but when he pitched it to me, I got jealous because I've heard of this case before. And then I started researching myself, and then I really wanted to be involved. So wait, am I the greedy one? That's my segue for today's sin. Greed.
And a content greedy.
Content greedy. Well, it's just...
Try to make a nice offer. Say, I'll take care of the podcast this week, babe. And she's like, that's such a good story. I'm telling half of it.
I was like, I can't... I remember hearing it on My Favorite Murder at one point. And I like remember researching it a little bit before. I don't know, like... It was probably on my list of about 1,000 cases that I want to cover. But yeah, I kind of got jealous. And yeah, so I don't know. Greed, I think, is the sin. But there's a motive that I can't really wrap my head around. And this is why you need to do this episode with me, is because I was just so dumbfounded with the motive. And you were like, no, I knew people like that. Like, you could wrap your head around the motive.
Certainly.
Yeah. So, anyways, welcome to the podcast, Greg Hunter.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sound engineer turned husband.
Turned.
He stalked me.
Co-host. For a short one time only. Special edition.
No. You'll do it more. I actually think we should do this more often.
Well, we co-host Deadly Diocese. If you haven't listened, here's a plug. Go listen.
Yeah, it's huge. And actually, we're probably going to have a season two fairly soon. And or hopefully, we'll see. We're working on it. There is some...
ample material, ample evidence.
Yes. Let's just say deathbed confession. Anywho's will be. All right.
The missing school bus. So I saw an article on the internet about this. And one, I'm already into buses. And so it was a pretty easy... you know, scroll stopper for me. I'm like, what? A missing school bus?
Do you want to explain why you're into buses? Because that is just so random.
Well, not only am I into buses, I would say I'm kind of an expert. And this knowledge will come into play later on in this story. I have, through owning my own bus, it was a tour bus for our band that happened to also be a Santa Monica Transit Blue Bus, you know, used to troll the beaches around Santa Monica in California in the 80s, early 90s. Anyhow, I got my hands on it through a police auction and turned it into my band's tour bus and drove it all over the country. And, you know, as sound as that Detroit diesel engine is, there's so many other things on a bus that can go wrong. So I've basically repaired everything that broke on that bus. And so yeah, I'm really familiar with some of the things they talk about in this particular episode.
Okay. Now that you're saying that,
my bus podcast soon.
There's a lot of red flags raising for me. Not only did you say you could understand the motive for this, but now, and you guys will understand a little bit, now that I'm hearing it in my mind's eye, like, okay, yeah. You could have committed this.
I would have kidnapped a rock and roll band. That likely, if you know,
you kidnapped me and made me marry you. So, anyways,
kidnapped a podcaster.
Okay. So we're gonna get into the case now. Hopefully, our little banter didn't annoy you too much up top, but you guys are with us. We love you, and hopefully, you love us. So, our sources for this episode are Nightmare and Chowchilla. It's a podcast, which is brilliantly done. Journalist and senior correspondent Claudia Cohen interviews the children who are now adults, the sheriff, the children's parents, and gets their firsthand accounts. I recommend checking that out, and also the 48 Hours documentary about this case. Other sources are CBS News, Wikipedia, CNN, and People.com. Why did three young men from wealthy families kidnap a school bus full of children in a tiny town in cow country of Central California? Many people that lived there were farmers, cowboys, ranchers. Chowchilla in 1976 was a town of less than 5,000 people. So, Greg, you know this because you were horrified when you eventually went to my, not horrified, but shocked, my hometown when we started dating. So let me walk through this. So I went to high school in Warrenton, Oregon. I was born in Astoria, Oregon. Astoria, you know, it's the Goonies town. If you've heard of it, that's the only way you would know. But Astoria was about 10,000-ish people. And the town over the bridge was Warrenton, you know, where we had our major shit going on. Warrenton Warriors High School had around 3,000 people in the entire town. So trying to fathom something of this nature in a town similar to mine is insane. Again, Chowchilla was less than 5,000 people in 1976. I went to high school in a town that was 3,000 people. Which Greg, being from Indianapolis and went to a big high school, he was genuinely shocked at how A, small my town was, and B, the size of my high school.
The size of her high school was the size of my elementary school. And the size of my high school was the size of her town. So, you know, I mean, I guess I come from a bigger city.
Yeah, but that's insane to me that this case that literally reached, I'm not joking, President Gerald Ford wanted to be updated about these kids. A Shah from, I think it was Iran. I don't know. I have to get that right, but like, it made global news because it was such a bizarre hostage kidnapping situation. One of the most famous in American history happened in this small town. Okay, let's get into it. So it's summer school, okay? Picture it. It was a pool day that day. They had been on a field trip all day at the pool at the Chowchilla Fairgrounds. It's just such innocence and so idyllic. Like, it's just, you know, it's summer school. They're at the pool. And their beloved bus
driver. That was not how my summer school was. Just for the record, like, man.
My town couldn't afford summer school. Anywho.
Chowchilla, you're doing something right.
And their beloved bus driver, Ed Ray, a man all the parents knew and the children loved, was driving. He was their favorite. He would put music on the bus and interact with the kids and watch out for them. He was a really good man. So Ed picks up 26 children, ranging in age from 5 to 14. And it was on this bus that this frightening ordeal began. And those children's innocence was lost that day. So around 4 p.m. on July 16th, 1976, Ed Ray stops the bus because there's a white van blocking the road. Being a kind man and in a small town where he's lived almost his whole life, Ed likely assumed maybe this person needed help. So he stops the bus on this rural country road and opens the bus door up. And then suddenly, two men with sawed-off double-barrel shotguns get onto the bus with pantyhose over their faces, and they force Ed to the back of the bus at gunpoint. The man then turns the gun on the kids, while the other man gets in the driver's seat of the bus and starts to drive, and then a third man follows behind in the white van. So at this point, unbeknownst to these terrified children's parents, three masked men with guns have hijacked the Dairyland Elementary School bus. Parents are arriving home from work, and their kids, who would normally be home and off the school bus by at 4:30 p.m. at the latest, were nowhere in sight. Mike, the 14-year-old that said, eventually, like later in life, that he was raised cowboy, And that's how he became a hero. He took that bus that day, which he normally never did, but his mom was unable to pick him up from school. And he's the one, like I said, that becomes the heroes of this story. Mike's mom started to get worried, though, when she arrived home around 4:30 and he wasn't there. Then 5:15 rolls around, still no sign of Mike. So she calls the school to see if her son Mike had gotten on the bus, and the secretary confirmed that he did. What was strange to her, too, though, is that when she called the school, there was a busy signal. Like, remember, this is 1976. Like, we don't have call waiting. Like, it's, you know, that means it was pretty late in the day for A, someone to be at the school. B, were there other parents calling? And C, the secretary tells her, yes, Mike did get on the bus, but we are missing a bus. She assured the parent that I'm sure that, like, maybe Ed Ray, the trusty, you know, trusted bus driver, maybe it just, you know, had a flat tire or something. Like, they are out there looking for the bus right now. Everything would be fine. But the mom knew. It was clear that something was very wrong. So the sheriff set up a command post and invited the parents there where they could have a question and answer type session. He needed to assure them that they had this handled, and they needed to get creative. Meanwhile, the kids hijacked on this bus are taken to a dry riverbed 7 miles from town. The driver of the white van then backs up a green or blue van, it's been said in different sources. Who knows? There's two vans now. Next to the school bus, and the kids are then forced off the bus at gunpoint. Jennifer, who was 9 years old at the time of the kidnapping, remembers what it felt like inside the van. She said, I felt like I was an animal going to the slaughterhouse. And inside the vans, the kidnappers had constructed makeshift jail cells by installing wood paneling and painting the windows so the kids could not see out and no one could see in. There was no air ventilation, food, water, or toilets. And this is the middle of the summer. Plywood was separating the children from their captors in the van, and it was a sweltering, probably plus 100 degree heat. And I think it's also Jennifer, which is hilarious. I like to call her the spicy little girl, told the kidnappers when her dad got a hold of them, it wouldn't be pretty. This little girl is literally threatening the kidnappers, which I find awesome and hilarious.
I love it.
It's pretty
my
cool.
My dad's gonna get you.
Yeah, he's a cowboy.
And
yeah.
You know, that had to be seeping into their minds just a little bit.
I hope it was.
Like,
this little girl.
What blows me away about these dumb criminals is that, yes, they're thinking, oh, we'll take kids. They're dumb and stupid. They're little. They'll be easy to cooperate and, you know, to have them do what we say. But 26 kids have 48 parents.
No, you're right, Greg. And those parents were not going to sit idle. After Mike's mom and other parents found that their kids were not at home, the school was just like, yeah, we have a bus missing. They went out on their own mission.
I gotta just interrupt real quick. A missing bus. That's gotta be hard for any parent to process. It's not a missing kid on the bus. It is a missing school bus.
Yeah.
A 40-foot long yellow metal tube full of all of their children just vanished. I'm curious if at that moment, if anybody was thinking like there was paranormal activity.
That is actually part of it.
Because, yeah.
They chill.
This is the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, they literally thought... Well, we're going to get into it.
All right.
So,
continue.
The bus is missing. All right. So, when Sheriff Bates holds this kind of like Q&A session to like just comfort the parents, talk, whatever, some of the parents also went out searching on their own, as did other locals. So one of the sergeants from the local police station had a pilot's license and was a pilot but didn't have a plane. but he knew another local county employee who did. So they borrowed that plane and went searching together.
Talk about the community coming together.
It's a nice community.
Only in farm country. Oh, I got a plane in the barn.
It feels like where we live here, honestly. Yeah. We're just like, all right, neighbors help neighbors. You know?
We're the only ones out here.
But what was hard for when the sergeant went out on the plane with the local who had one, the bus route wasn't a normal one because it was summer school. So the kids were dropped off into kind of different places or picked up from different places. But then a local farmer, so this is the whole community getting together. A local farmer also got his plane out and he was the one to spot the empty bus. So the reason why the bus was empty is because they unloaded the kids one by one off of that bus into the green van, the white van, and then they drove them around, again, at gunpoint. And one of these girls, Jennifer, was still in her pink bathing suit from her pool day. And they made them give their names, their an article of clothing, and just treated them like adult hostages and loaded them off into these vans, drove them for 12 hours, 100 miles away to Livermore, California, into a rock quarry.
It should be noted that they just drove around for 12 hours. Livermore's only an hour away, but they just drove them around to confuse them. And it was a good, that's the only part of their plot that like kind of worked. Because I think, one, they didn't expect, like, we're going to hide this bus in this dried-out riverbed. No one will find it for days. But, nope, local farmer gets in his crop duster, is flying around and spots the plane, like, boom. Immediately their plane is starting to be foiled. And I'm sure those criminals never thought that the plane was, or that the bus was going to be found so soon.
But it was only able to be found from an aerial view. Like that, that's one of the things that's so insane. So they did kind of do a good job of that. And one of the parents that went out looking for their kid along the bus route, noticed that it's a small town. So there wouldn't be like traffic, but there were a bunch of cars, you know, around. And so they stopped and, another mother came up from the ravine crying, like sobbing. And, basically, the other mother asks, like, where are the kids? And she says, there's a bus, but it's empty. And so they're thinking,
horrifying.
Like what? And you got to think about this. So the bus is found. There are no children in it. I mean, they must have been freaking out. Had they all been taken to a hospital? Had they wandered off into the woods? This is like a missing 411 case nightmare. Hopefully you've listened to those episodes so you know what that means. But it's just complete just commotion. And where are these children? There's just an empty bus covered in bamboo trees trying to be hidden. Thankfully that farmer, you know, found it. But like, how did the kids vanish? Think about it. It's 1976, essentially at the height of the serial killer boom. Okay, think about that too. Serial killers that operated in the Bay Area and right up and down the highways near Chowchilla, California. Around this time, there was the Santa Rosa Hitchhiker Killer. He was responsible for murders that were credited to at least 7 unsolved homicides involving female hitchhikers in the San Francisco area. His first victims were 2 12-year-olds who disappeared on February 4th, 1972. So that guy's operating. You have the Golden State Killer. Then you also have the Zebra Killers, which is a pseudo-culty case I plan to cover in the future, but it was in the 1970s, and many people were just randomly killed. Randomly killed. So these parents in the Chowchilla town were probably like, what is happening? There were also theories that it could have been like an alien abduction. And this story made national, actually international news. Like I said, President Gerald Ford wanted to be updated on every move. And eventually, President Gerald Ford called on the Attorney General to authorize any search and rescue to all authorities, any department to aid in the small farm town. They needed help, and the president was on the case. Where were these kids? It seemed like the perfect kidnapping and ransom plan, until it wasn't. So what happens next is the most terrifying. So they'd been driven around for hours without food, water. They ended up having to go to the bathroom in the center of the van. They tried to sing songs to make themselves feel better. But then the moment came when they were unloaded out one by one, forced to give their names and family details and an article of clothing, and then sent into a hole. At 3:30 a.m., 100 miles away from their home, after the 12-hour van ride, the children were taken to a rock quarry in Livermore, California, where they were unloaded one by one at gunpoint into a hole in the ground. They were told to climb down a ladder into a dark hole. Literally, they haven't had any creature comforts for 12 hours. And now they were ordered to crawl into a pre-made bunker into the ground. The hole was a truck trailer buried 12 feet deep. The kidnappers then tell Edward that they'd be back for him. They give the kids some toilet paper, a flashlight, some batteries, but then they were gone, going to collect their ransom money. The only adult trapped underground with these little kids was the bus driver, Edward Ray, and he was reluctant to try to escape. He was afraid that they were up there. They were ready to kill them if they escaped. But this 14-year-old boy, Mike Marshall, was willing to take that bet. He said, "I thought to myself, if we're going to die, we're going to die getting the hell out of here." Greg, can you imagine being a little kid who's essentially being buried alive? Like, they're kids. 14 is still a kid in my mind.
Absolutely.
But five to 14? Yeah, 5 years old to 14 years old was the age range.
Absolutely wild. And it's like the classic, like, you're in an unmarked van. It's guys with pantyhose and sawed-off shotguns. It's like the movies. It's how you imagine it to be and as scary as possible. And now you're underground. You hear them throwing the dirt on top. And it's almost pitch black. And I'm sure it's smelly. I'm sure the kidnappers thought they were so smart. You know, like, oh, we're giving them bathrooms. We're cutting little holes in the wheel wells for them to poop in. And here's a roll of toilet paper. Like, true kindness.
And it was truly the only creature comforts these kids got for the last 12 hours. I mean, they were driven around in the dark in a van or vans for 12 hours. And now they also threw out some food, some cereal. Yeah,
I heard an interview from a survivor, and she was actually like, well, it wasn't initially that bad until the food and water ran out. Because it was an improvement almost. They were in this scorching hot van with no ventilation and couldn't see anything and had no idea what was next. At least it was like they got a little bit of like the next chapter is not death.
Yeah.
And there's food and water, so like they're not trying to kill them immediately at least. And well, I'm sure at that point, after driving around in a van aimlessly with no AC in the hot California desert in July for 12 hours, food and water was like, oh, and a place to use the bathroom. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it was something, and some survivors mentioned that like, you know, that was better than them peeing in the middle of the van like they had been before.
Yeah. Yeah, and they had also mentioned, too, like, yes, they had a place to go to the bathroom, but they were also having to do it in front of their, like, school classmates. Like, it's just so just scary.
Traumatizing.
Yeah, it's just scary.
Kindergartner.
Yeah.
Fourth grader. Wild.
But they did have peanut butter, which I appreciate.
But once the peanut butter ran out and they were left to their own devices, you know, it's just now 26 kids in an old box trailer buried underground with one adult and one macho man cowboy, Mike Marshall. And thank God he was there, because it was really his perseverance that I think pushed Ed to be motivated to, like, all right, let's not just kick the bucket, as he said. Like, we're going to be down here to kick the bucket. That's what I think kind of got Mike Marshall thinking, like, this can't be it. Mm-hmm. And then, from all of the weight of the dirt and the big bus batteries and the sheet metal, the trailer ceiling started to collapse. And there's screeching metal, and all the kids are screaming and freaking out.
They have to huddle in a corner, like, away from, like, the debris.
Well, they all huddled to one side, and the truck had caved in, or the moving trailer, semi-trailer, basically. They're in a semi-trailer, you can imagine, buried underground. Caved in enough that, like, it would hit your head if you were standing up, but it wasn't like totally, you know, like, it didn't break. The dirt didn't come in at that point. But Ed and Mike Marshall got the bright idea to stack up all the mattresses that the kidnappers had left for them to reach the latch, the hatch.
Like the manhole cover.
Well, the manhole cover was on top of a kind of escape hatch.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of the manhole cover was batteries. Big bus or like semi-truck, not like your everyday Ford pickup truck.
I can't even imagine how big those are.
Well, I know exactly how big they are.
How big are they?
In most cases with a big diesel engine, we're talking about 2 8D batteries that are equivalent to 4 car batteries. 4 12-volt car batteries.
So say the size. The size is
like, I'd say 2.5 feet by 16 inches. Okay. Like 4 cinder blocks.
Okay.
And the weight is, it's every bit of 120 pounds. Mm-hmm. Like, it takes all of my strength to pull my bus batteries out of the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 of them on a manhole cover, I mean, like, that's some serious weight.
That's what's crazy, too. So now that makes more sense. So when one of the other kids who was interviewed later describes Mike just strong-arming up and having the strength, like, he didn't know where he got that strength. Like, how this 14-year-old boy... I mean, and he also just says that, like, he was raised cowboy, so that's how he was able to do it. That was, like, a quote from somewhere that Mike said.
He's got ranch boy strength.
Yeah. But, like, this younger kid is watching him, like, do the – and easily it could have taken his arm off, he said, if he
– Well, if Ed – so you got to imagine they've stacked up all the mattresses to this escape hatch, and Ed Ray, the adult, the bus driver, is on top of a bunch of mattresses using all of his strength to push up on his shoulders the escape hatch just enough that Mike can fit his arm through. And if Ed loses his strength, that his arm's coming off. Like,
but it's also mattresses, so think about, like, having to, like, hold your core
unstable.
And it's like, it's unstable. Like, gosh.
And so Mike only has one arm available to move the manhole cover, the bus batteries, and eventually he got wise, and they broke apart one of the box springs from the mattresses and took a piece of wood and use it as a pry bar.
Oh.
In the opening. But basically, Mike Marshall was able to, with one arm, move 120, 150-pound batteries. And even more impressively later, after he got through the hatch, they're still buried. That just moved the hatch out of the way. There was, you know, I've looked at some photos online. There's maybe a couple feet then between the plywood that the kidnappers put down over the hole they had dug and put the trailer in it. So imagine you dig out a box, like you dig out a square shape, you put a trailer in it, there's dirt walls on either side. They laid plywood across that.
over the top,
covering the trailer. So they didn't have to throw dirt right on top of the trailer. They threw dirt
on top of the plywood.
On top of the plywood.
Oh my God,
at least
I didn't
over
know this.
The hatch. So that way they had easier access to the hatch when they were going to get the kids out.
Oh, I see.
Presumably.
They could just lift the plywood up.
Yes, presumably after they got their ransom money.
Wow.
So.
It's a brilliant plan and a terrible plan all at the same time. I mean, it's obviously...
It's a really good movie script idea, which is what they stole it from. The kidnappers, they basically took this from a scene from Dirty Harry, where the Scorpio killer does the same thing and kidnaps a bus full of children.
See, my theory, and we'll get to motive, but like... Okay, when I say it's like a great plan and a terrible plan at the same time, it's obviously terrible because little kids are being kidnapped and parents are traumatized, the kids are traumatized... It's all terrible. But I'm talking about, like, the intelligence of the criminals. But to me, like, the only thing I can go to is, like, were drugs involved? Like, what would make... And not that I've ever even done any drug that would make me have the confidence to do anything, but, like, I've read enough about it. Like, were you on PCP? Were you on meth? Like, what would make someone... do this.
I don't think so. I think this was purely greed, status, and pride. These kids came from affluent families. They couldn't be touched. In fact, 15 months earlier, these same kids were arrested for a seemingly an insurance fraud plot. They got caught pushing a car over a cliffside.
For what
reason? In a national park.
Oh, for insurance fraud.
Probably insurance fraud.
When you say
fraud,
kids, they're young men. I mean, they're adults.
They're young men. They're 22 and 24, but we will get there.
Yeah.
Because right now, Mike Marshall and Ed Ray and 25 others are still stuck underground. So Mike Marshall has crawled through the hatch, but they're still buried alive. And he's got just a couple feet between the roof of the trailer and the plywood that the kidnappers put down to then put dirt on top of to bury them alive. And he's trying everything to find a weak spot in the plywood, to find the edge. And he's using that same makeshift piece of wood that he uses as a pry bar to scrape away at the dirt until he finally finds the edge of the plywood.
It's crazy.
And there's so much weight on it that he can't push himself out. He can't move the plywood, so he's pulling down on it, where he's got more torque and strength. And
he's like doing like a pull-up kind of?
I mean, he's pulling down on the edge of the plywood.
Okay.
And you gotta think this is a 14-year-old boy, and this is likely a 1-inch piece of plywood, maybe thicker. This is strong. This is like this, they put this down for floors for people to walk on for 50 years. It's like you can't punch through it. You can't, it's extremely strong. And this kid, in another feat of supernatural strength, even for a full grown man,
jeez,
breaks the plywood.
He breaks it?
He pulled the edge of the plywood and broke off a piece, and all of a sudden, dirt and debris, and most importantly, sunlight starts pouring in to the trailer. It came in so fast that Mike himself was forced back through the hole onto the mattresses. All this dirt is rushing in, and the children have been, Ed had them put t-shirts over their faces and wet them so they could actually breathe, because as Mike was digging out, all of this dust was coming into the trailer. And so finally, for the first time in 16 hours, the children could breathe somewhat fresh air and see sunlight.
Shit, you're doing a good job. I feel genuinely shocked. I did not know that part of it. And I only know from like when we're building our house, like when we move, like the OSB, is that what it's called?
OSB is nothing compared to this. Okay, we have a sheet of plywood up there.
Okay.
It's what we walk on over our trench.
Okay, yeah, he broke something like that, and like I can barely lift it with you.
Yeah, it'd be like 45 pounds, maybe heavier, just the wood alone.
Holy shit.
It's very impressive. Mike certainly has that cowboy strength. But it was now 8 p.m. They all crawl out, one by one. Ed hands them to Mike, and they are now outside, seeing the world again, feeling the world again, feeling hope again. And where are they? After 12 hours of driving aimlessly around in the kidnappers' vans, surprisingly, they're only a few hours away from Chowchilla, in Livermore, California, in a rock quarry. All right. For any of you conspiracy theorists out there, Rachel did not get abducted or kidnapped herself. She won't be on the rest of this episode because she had to pick up her mom from the airport. So I'm going to take us home, finishing out this wild kidnapping story. So it was 8 p.m., and all of the children, led by Mike Marshall and Ed Ray, were hiking through this giant quarry they've never been to or know where they're even at. And after the ordeal of being buried alive for 16 hours and kidnapped for more than 24, Ed Ray climbs up on a sandbar and can see a security outpost, a building of some sort, and decides that everyone is going to walk towards that building hand in hand. And as they walk towards the building, a guard runs out and starts yelling, "I know who you are. I know who you are." And he wasn't the only one. In the last 30 hours, this story had gone global. In the 70s, before social media, this was a truly viral story. Everyone needed to know what happened to those 26 school children and the missing school bus. And it was the viral nature of this true crime kidnapping story that set the town of Chowchilla on fire with worry and anxiety. Everyone was concerned and everyone was looking. And that's what ultimately foiled the kidnappers' plot. You see, three affluent men from wealthy families in the Bay Area, Fred Woods, James, and Richard Schoenfield, had hatched the perfect kidnapping plot from a movie they'd seen, Dirty Harry. They were following in the footsteps of the Scorpio Killer. The only thing was, when they tried to demand their ransom, they couldn't get through to the cops. They kept calling and calling, but the line was busy. So they did what any young, dumb, full of confidence with their plan criminals would do. Take a nap. Sleep on it. But by the time they woke up, not only did the whole world know about their criminal kidnapping plot, the bus had been found, and the children had escaped. So who were these knucklehead kidnappers with rich parents? Fred Woods, Richard, and James Schoenfeld, the Schoenfeld brothers. Well, you should know that all three were arrested 15 months before this kidnapping for pushing a car off a cliff in a suspected insurance fraud scam. But their parents pulled some strings at the county courthouse. They got off with a slap on the wrist. And the rock quarry? Well, that was owned by Fred Wood's dad. And you see, he was kind of a motorhead. He would buy old cars, vans, trucks, buses, and get them running again. So that was part of the puzzle. He had access to old kidnapper vans, blacked out windows. And he already had a moving trailer that he could bury at his old man's quarry. So it wasn't too difficult for Fred to imagine that he and his Schoenfeld brother buddies could pull this off. But why? What was the motivation for these three privileged white kids from the Bay Area to try to kidnap 26 children and a bus driver? Well, apparently, they were in some debt, some serious debt. Few million dollars after some failed business ventures went south. But even still, couldn't they have gone to their parents? Yes, they were from rich families, but their pride was far too great to ask their parents for money. No, they were better than that. You see, they believed they could outsmart the law and the love 48 parents would endure from a $5 million ransom. Richard Schoenfeld was even quoted saying, "We will need multiple victims to get multiple millions. And children will be cooperative and vulnerable." I'm not sure what their greater deadly sin is, greed or pride. These fools thought they were just better than everything. Better than the law in a small town, smarter than all the parents of 26 children. So why work hard on another failed business venture? Clearly, they're no good at that. But, I mean, of course, they'd be great criminals. I mean, they watch Dirty Harry. They would be great Scorpio killers, right? So they set out on a mission to scout lonely farm towns, looking for the right small town with little to no police patrol. And they zero in on Chowchilla. And they take over a year plotting out this kidnapping, little by little, convincing themselves that this cinematic heist story that they've scripted out in their own minds is going to work, and they're going to get $5 million. Because you see, in their minds, they had thought of everything except the human spirit and the willpower of a kid who wants to live. The strength of a child's spirit and the willpower to overcome and persevere was a variable Fred, James, and Richard hadn't calculated in the year and a half they dreamt this up. Oh, they thought to cut out toilet holes in the wheel wells of this moving trailer. But they didn't think that a bunch of elementary school kids would be clever, coy, sly enough to weasel their way out of that scenario while they left them unattended, buried under a sheet of plywood, some bus batteries, and a manhole cover. So needless to say, Fred Woods and the Schoenfeld brothers' kidnap for ransom plot was falling apart quick. They were going to be caught. After all, they buried the kids in Fred Woods' father's sand quarry. So it was only a matter of time. Richard Schoenfeld had had enough and turned himself in. Fred Woods and James Schoenfeld went on the run. As clue after clue was coming in to the cops, it wasn't long before they were apprehended. The prosecution decided to hold the trial in Alameda County, where the quarry was, because the county was much larger and had a lot more resources available to make sure they could put these three guys behind bars forever. All three men pleaded guilty to the kidnapping charges behind a literal quarry full of evidence. But what this case hinges on is the bodily harm charge. All three of them disputed that they did not intentionally hurt or injure any of the children or Ed Ray. The reason that this is so important is because without the prosecution being able to successfully attach the bodily harm charge to the guilty verdict, all three men would be eligible for parole. But in 1977, armed with multiple testimonies from kidnapped children, the court ruled that all three men were guilty of 27 counts of kidnapping for ransom and bodily harm, sentencing them to life without parole. But in a classic government makes the wrong decision type of ironic move, for no reason at all, in 1981, the bodily harm charge was overturned and they were granted parole hearings. And because no one died in the kidnappings, they were allowed to have parole hearings every 2 years. And they filed for them, creating a cascading domino effect of mental trauma for the kidnapped children for years and years and decades to come, until finally they started getting out. Richard Schoenfield was paroled in 2012 at the age of 57. 3 years later, James Schoenfield was paroled in 2015 at the age of 63. But the parole board decided to keep the mastermind, quote-unquote, Frederick Newhall Woods, imprisoned, repeatedly denying his parole, until finally, in August 2022, one of his victims came to his aid at a parole hearing. And with this victim's forgiving testimony, at the age of 70, Fred Woods was granted full parole. Later, when asked about it, this particular victim, Larry Park, said, "I was Fred Woods' victim for 36 hours. I was my own victim for 35 years." Wow, what a wild ride. Literally and figuratively. Thanks for letting me be your metaphorical true crime bus driver on this crazy 1970s kidnapping tale. I don't usually get to do the sign-off. Actually, I never get to do the sign-off, except on my rare Christmas episodes. That reminds me, I should give Rachel that gift of a week off and do the Seven Heavenly Virtues Christmas special episode. So I'll be plotting on that. But anyhow, we love you guys. Truly, I want you all to know that my wife, Rachel, puts everything into this podcast and truly loves hearing feedback from you guys. It makes her days and her weeks, and she's always so committed to putting together an amazing podcast for you. And yeah, I just want you guys to know that. It truly is her art form, and I love that I get to do this with her. So thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We hope you continue to, and we want to keep telling stories you love and enjoy, and that need attention. So send us stories, good or bad, cult leaders or miracle workers. Let us know. I hope that if it's snowing where you're at, like it's snowing here, you're staying warm and having a great time. We hope you have a fantastic week coming up. And signing off, I'm Greg Hunter, filling in for the incomparable, the beautiful, my wife, Rachel O'Brien. Goodbye.